Chapter 32, Tittenhurst Times. At Tittenhurst, Prabhupada immediately took up the same routine he always followed wherever he went. Rising early in the morning to translate, chanting, lecturing, taking a morning walk, and maintaining his global movement through letters. He continued to spread Krishna consciousness in the modest, methodical way he had ever done since I had ever known him. Each morning we walked with him through the eucalyptus trees and California redwoods, some 100 feet tall, that had been planted around the Tittenhurst estate. As the mild September weather gave way to genuine autumn, Prabhupada donned a heavy coat, black Russian hat, and Wellington boots to protect him from the rainy, windy climate. We strolled through fields of long grass in the wee hours of the morning and along the meandering pathways that ran into the main house. We never bumped into John and Yoko, who I figured were probably sound asleep at that hour. Prabhupada's airport reception was covered by a number of high-profile newspapers, including The Sun and The Daily Sketch, each of which had large photographs accompanying their news articles. Beneath the headline, Enter His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, the sketch featured a 2-page photo of Prabhupada playing the kartals and chanting with his eyes closed. The Sun's back page showed a 1/2-page photograph of all the devotees bowing down, and the headline read, Happiness is Hare Krishna. When I showed Prabhupada the newspapers the morning after his arrival, he smiled broadly. This photo, he said, indicating the one of him with closed eyes, this photo is very nice. I am thinking we should send it to Jadurani in America to paint. Yes, it is a great shot, I agreed. I was in ecstasy, Prabhupada said. Usually, he just glanced at the newspaper photos of himself without much comment, if any. But this photographer had captured the mood of that very special airport reception. While I am here in London, Prabhupada said, looking up from the newspaper, I am wanting to give lectures to the public. Okay, we can probably arrange something, I said. You must arrange, he insisted. I have many public engagements in America, and if I have none here, then I must return to America soon. I'll talk to Gurudas and Shyamasundara about it when they get back from the Berry Place Temple tonight, I said. Maybe we can rent a hall or something. That would be very nice, Prabhupada said. Somewhere in center of London, perhaps. That evening, the three of us agreed that we couldn't let Prabhupada leave London only because we hadn't managed to organize any worthwhile public programs. It was our goal to keep him with us for at least 3 months, so Gurudas suggested that we arrange a series of 13 lectures that would be delivered once a week by Prabhupada to an audience that we would recruit via advertising. The next morning, Gurudas presented the proposal to Prabhupada and handed him a typewritten list of the lectures we were suggesting he give. Teachings of the Vedas, the Golden Avatar, the Song of God, and others. Prabhupada scrutinized the list. So I start on 28th September, he asked. We exchanged excited looks. Yes, that's what we're thinking, Srila Prabhupada, Shyamasundara said. That is okay, he said. Overjoyed at our success in securing his presence until December, we quickly hired a place called Conway Hall, an austere but well-kept auditorium opposite a park called Red Lion Square, only 5 blocks from Berry Place. Inside, the 600 audience seats were bolted to the floor, and the wood panels on the wall looked as if they had all been cut from the same tree. With a stage, curtains, and sound system, and a mezzanine balcony on 3 sides, the hall had everything we needed. Plus, it had the added bonus of being inexpensive. A few days before his first lecture, Prabhupada suggested some ideas for how we should position ourselves on the stage. This is London, he said. It is important that we are looking nice. He took a piece of paper from the stack on his desk and began to sketch. The drawing looked something like the game strategy diagrams football coaches draw on boards in locker rooms. Top of page is edge of stage, and bottom of page is backside, he said, and these are tables. He indicated 2 horizontal rectangles in the middle of the page. You can use tables from here, tables we use for prasadam. He drew a small rectangle between the large ones. This is harmonium. Yamuna will sit here for singing. I will sit on left side with my Radha Krishna deities, who will sit on my right. You understand? I nodded. He drew 2 columns along the left and right margins of the page. This is where you will all be. Is that all right? Yes, I said. So you mean that the other devotees will sit and chant along each side of the stage? Yes, he said. You will chant, dance, play mridanga, kartals, clap hands, and during lecture you will sit in same way to listen. What if we sat in curved lines instead of straight lines, I suggested. That way the audience could see all the devotees. Oh yes, Prabhupada said, that will be very good. He drew curved lines over the straight lines and handed me the sheet of paper. We figured it would take a lot of publicity to fill the hall, so we made a big push to advertise the lectures by distributing thousands of handbills on Oxford Street. Our efforts paid off. The first evening saw about 400 people in the audience, each of whom paid 10 shillings at the door. I thought the stage setup looked very professional. Being 3 foot above the stage floor in the cushioned tables, Prabhupada and the devotees were clearly visible, even from the back of the room. I'd found an archaic-looking music stand that was just the right height for Prabhupada to use as a bookstand. And we had made a 15-foot purple cloth banner with a mantra on it in large yellow letters. This banner was the backdrop. The evening opened with Jamuna leading a gentle kirtan for which we all stood in formation and danced as we played our motley collection of instruments, kartals, tambora, mridanga, and even trumpet. Jamuna then played the harmonium to accompany Prabhupada's pre-lecture kirtan. I watched the audience as Prabhupada sang and then lectured, and I could see that many were listening intently. When he asked for questions, a middle-aged man stood up. "Why have you come all the way to London?" he asked in a booming voice. He spoke with an impeccable Oxbridge accent. "Why not focus on the Indian people and stay in your own country? You could influence the important politicians there." "You are a great politician," Prabhupada instantly answered. "Therefore, I have approached you." The man blinked. "Thank you," he said quietly, and sat down. From her place behind the harmonium, Yamuna let out a loud, "Ha, ha," which echoed through the silent hall. The other devotees giggled at the sound as she covered her mouth with her right hand and looked around, embarrassed. Prabhupada indicated she should lead another kirtan, so she began to sing, and the rest of us danced in clockwise circles around Prabhupada and the deities as we played our instruments. We were thrilled with the success of our opening night, but after the first few lectures, the size of the audience began to dwindle. We didn't have enough money to keep producing the number of handbills we distributed for the first lecture. I did some research on advertising in the daily paper, but this proved far beyond our means. Getting Prabhupada from Tittenhurst to London was also more expensive than we had anticipated. £25 round trip, and we found ourselves dipping into the Conway Hall entrance takings. We printed a few handbills each week, but we never managed to regain the size of the original crowds. Nevertheless, the Conway Hall lectures proved an important body of knowledge and an inspiration for the devotees around the world who eagerly awaited recordings of each one. One of the lectures, Wisdom of the Vedas, became the introduction to Prabhupada's book, Sri Ishopanishad, and a profile photo of Prabhupada taken at Conway Hall became part of the banner logo on the cover of Back to Godhead magazine. Every morning during our 2 months at Tittenhurst, while the Berry Place premises was under renovation, we had a program in a small building called the Conservatory, which had been used for chamber music recitals in days now long gone. Although it had good acoustics for kirtan, it was always icy, particularly at 4 a.m, which was when our morning program began. We erected a simple altar for Jagannath deities at one end of the conservatory and an elevated seat on the right wall from which Prabhupada spoke each morning. Before the early morning aarti ceremony, I made my shivery way to the conservatory to sweep the floor and turn on the kerosene burners to take the edge off the room's chill. Still, it was barely warmer in the conservatory than it was outside in the frost, and the cold got into my bones. It was like listening to Srila Prabhupada lecture inside an industrial walk-in fridge. There were very few of us staying at Tittenhurst, and the intimate atmosphere allowed us to ask Prabhupada lots of questions. One morning, I went to where he was sitting and asked him about the way kirtans were performed historically. "How did Lord Chaitanya do kirtan in the 16th century?" I asked, my breath making small clouds as I spoke. "What did the chanting parties look like in those days?" "Yes," he paused, smiling like he was pleased with my question. He leaned forward as though he was revealing something very private. Krishnadas Kaviraj writes of this in his Chaitanya Chaitamrita. "There were 2 mridanga players, 2 dancers, and 7 kartals. Other people would join, but the main ones, the mridangas, kartal men, and the dancers, they were the center." He spoke quietly, as if telling me a secret. "The mridanga players, they would inspire the dancers," he continued. "And the dancers, they would inspire the mridangas. One person would lead, and the rest, they would respond. Like we do here in temple, lead and respond." He paused, In this way, they created ecstatic feelings by chanting the holy names very expertly. When leader chanted, drums and cymbals would play quiet, so everyone could hear. Then when everyone sang, drums and kartals played loud. And when leader sang again, they would play soft again. So, soft and loud, they would go on in that way and repeat. Later that morning, I pulled on my green sports jacket and walked out the gate to wait for the number 7 Green Line bus. I had a busy day ahead of me. Prabhupada wanted larger premises for the temple, so I was going to view a couple of potential properties. I also had to meet a few wealthy donors for the new temple, and I was capitalizing on our position in the music charts by organizing a weekend engagement for the band to earn some extra money for the temple. Instead of thinking about practical matters, though, I mused about how we could implement the kirtan techniques that Prabhupada had spoken about earlier that morning. The bus arrived, and as it crawled through the traffic, I decided it would be practically impossible to orchestrate that kind of kirtan in a temple. Practically impossible because of the spontaneous nature of such a setting. You never knew who exactly would be there and how long they would stay. It would be possible, I thought, only in a more controlled setting with participants who had a degree of musical sophistication. Prabhupada often spoke about his long-cherished dream for a world Sankirtan party. This would consist of 25 or so devotees who would travel the world performing kirtan at prestigious venues. I wondered if our being in the charts might assist us in forming that kind of party, the kind that Prabhupada had envisioned. Thoughts of Lord Chaitanya's kirtan party stayed with me for the rest of the day as I made my way through my to-do list. When I arrived back at Tittenhurst that evening, exhausted from our meeting with potential donors, I found that another of our donors, a good friend, had called on the estate to meet Prabhupada. His name was Mr. Parikh. He was a slightly bespectacled man of Gujarati origin who had come to England via Kenya, where he had been a schoolmaster. He was an influential member of the Indian community and had helped us in numerous ways. Several months before, he had sponsored and accompanied us to Leeds in Yorkshire, where we performed kirtan in a Hindu hall to an enthusiastic crowd of about 500 people. Parikh was so enchanted with our performance that he started calling us the real Hindus. When I pushed open the door that evening, Gurudas was waiting for me in the hallway. Purushottam didn't let Mr. Parikh see Prabhupada, he exclaimed. Mr. Parikh was here? I asked. Yeah, he came by bus, Gurudas said. It took him 4 hours, and he had to change buses 6 times. Prabhupada was resting when he got here, and Purushottam wouldn't wake him up. Did you tell him that they'd written letters to each other, I asked, and that Prabhupada would want to see Mr. Parikh? I couldn't tell him anything, Gurudas said, exasperated. We were out working on the main house, and when I got back, Mr. Parikh was gone. How long did he wait? 2 hours, Gurudas said. He left and didn't see Prabhupada, I groaned. Oh, man. I was appalled that an elderly man who was such a good friend would have made the arduous journey for nothing. Prabhupada's angry at Purushottam. He said he doesn't know how to conduct himself in England. Can we make it up to Mr. Parikh? I wondered aloud. I'm sure Prabhupada will want to see him again, Gurudas said. I thought that Prabhupada would remain unhappy with Purushottam for quite a while, given the magnitude of his blunder. But the next day, when I entered his room before heading off to London for the day, I was surprised to see them interacting, as though nothing had happened. Prabhupada looked over at me and sat down behind his desk. Your coat is a little soiled, he asked. I looked down at my sports jacket. Yeah, I guess it is, I admitted. Prabhupada often said, cleanliness is next to godliness, and I thought that I was pretty clean in general. But now I saw my favorite sports coat with new eyes. It wasn't just a little soiled, it was stained and just plain dirty. In London, you dress, then undress. Dress, then a-dress, he said. Do you understand? You should have a nice suit, like Purushottam. He nodded toward his assistant, who was now sitting in the corner of the room. Purushottam was wearing a dark blue, pinstriped, three-piece suit, beaming from ear to ear, obviously relieved to be vindicated from his gaffe with Parikh. Okay, I said, I'll buy a suit too. That'll make me look more official. Prabhupada nodded, and I left the room. I sought out Janaki. Prabhupada wants me to get a suit like Purushottam's, I told her. He said here in London we should look nice. Janaki took it in stride. I'll come with you, she offered. We should go to Austin Reed. They've got nice stuff in there. Riding the bus into London, I realized that many of the London business people I was dealing with recently had indeed looked me up and down the first time they'd met me. I didn't want to look like a grungy American. At Austin Reed, we found a well-cut, dark blue, three-piece suit. Janaki also convinced me to buy a dark blue wool overcoat. I wore everything out of the shop and around London for my errands, careful to hold an umbrella over my head to prevent my new clothes from getting damp. When we arrived back at Tittenhurst at the end of the day, I planned to show Prabhupada my purchases. Janaki and I were making our way down the gravel path toward our rooms when we saw Prabhupada and Purushottam walking toward us. I prepared to offer my respects by bowing down before him, but as I bent my legs, I realized how muddy the narrow gravel path was. I remembered the devotees who had run out onto the tarmac a few weeks earlier and had bowed down before Prabhupada, unconcerned with the puddles and dirt that had stained their cotton robes. But there seemed to be a big difference between dirtying a piece of cotton cloth and soaking a three-piece suit in mud. And anyway, Prabhupada had rebuked me just this morning for wearing dirty clothes. I straightened up and then changed my mind again and prepared to bow down. Then saw the mud and straightened up once again. By the time Prabhupada reached us, he was laughing out loud. "Prabhupada, I wanted to bow down, but then I thought, that's all right," he said, chuckling. And I knew he understood my predicament and was happy. I hadn't dirtied my new suit and coat. He was obviously less concerned with my observing Vedic etiquette than he was that I be appropriately dressed to talk to people in London. That night, I thought about the Parikh incident and about my suit and tried to assimilate the inner meaning of the events. Just before Prabhupada had arrived in London, I had received a letter from him in which he'd said, "I am so proud of having beautiful disciples like you who understood the inner meaning of my message." I was struck by the phrase, inner meaning, and had thought about the significance of finding an inner meaning of things ever since. I realized that while regulations were essential for progress in spiritual life, I had to remember that pleasing Krishna and the spiritual master was not a simple matter of following rules. On the contrary, in special circumstances, it was the right thing to violate custom for a higher purpose, to wake the spiritual master from his sleep to see an important guest, or to not bow down in order to preserve an expensive suit. Some years later, I even heard that one devotee had complained that he wouldn't be able to open a temple in a communist country because there was no vegetarian food to eat. Prabhupada's response was, "Then eat meat, but spread Krishna consciousness like anything." The art of being tuned into the spiritual master preoccupied my thoughts all evening. My conclusion that night was that it takes time to learn to love someone, and even more time to know what they want most. During our stay at Tittenhurst, Janaki, Malati, and Jamuna befriended a red-haired Scottish woman named Mrs. McDougall, who was living in a small Georgian house on the property. Her husband was a bricklayer who was working on the estate and whom the Lennons were happy to accommodate in addition to paying him. However, McDougall, the bricklayer, was a very quiet man. One evening, Janaki told me that Mrs. McDougall had confided in her that she and her husband were being kept awake at night by strange noises coming from the top floor of their house. They were afraid they were going to lose their home and employment because Mr. McDougall had to sleep during the day and wasn't getting enough work done on the Lennon property. "They're convinced it's a ghost," Janaki said. "She said she thinks it's the work of the deal. I think that's Scottish for devil. She asked me if I thought she was crazy, and I said, no, the Vedas say it's possible for a soul to be in a ghost body. I mean a subtle body, but no material body and senses. Maybe they should tell John and Yoko," I suggested. "I said the same thing," Janaki said. "She said they told him, and Yoko hired an exorcist to get rid of it, but he couldn't do anything about it. He said the ghost was too powerful." "What kind of sounds do they hear?" I asked. "She said they hear heavy chains rattling and something being dragged across the floor." "Like what?" "She said it sounded like a body being dragged, or the boots." "Chains and dragged bodies sounds pretty cliche to me," I said. I had always been skeptical about ghosts and supernatural beings, but when I met Prabhupada, I discovered that ghosts appear in many of the scriptures in India. Although the Vedas supported the idea of some ghosts being friendly, most of them seemed to be malevolent because they were frustrated. According to the Vedas, ghosts still had minds and desired food, sex, and other sensory pleasures, but they could not fulfill these desires because they had no sense organs. Prabhupada said it was possible for a disembodied being to continue to reside in a particular house because of excessive attachment to the dwelling. He also said some powerful ghosts had the ability to possess other bodies to gratify their desires, especially the bodies of those who had taken alcohol or drugs or were in some kind of vulnerable state. They're really upset about it. Can we ask Prabhupada what we should do? I think so, I said. When I told Prabhupada about the situation, his response was direct. Drive it out, he said gravely. How? I asked. They hired an exorcist and even he couldn't help. Yes, but Krishna can, Prabhupada insisted. On a cloudy day, ask the people to leave the house. Then you have loud kirtan. Use mridanga kartals and keep blowing conch shell. Sprinkle water offered to Krishna on floor. Burn lots of incense. You must chant Hare Krishna in the house all day. You think that will drive away the gross? I asked a little doubtfully. Yes, he said with certainty. A ghost cannot remain in presence of Krishna's name. A couple of hours later, 20 devotees gathered in the McDougal's home for a spirited Hare Krishna chanting session. We're going to be a few hours, Janaki said to Mrs. McDougal. Why don't you take a walk? Well, there's a wee bit of rain, but we can take our brawlies, Mrs. McDougal agreed. The kirtan lasted 5 hours. We threaded our way through all the rooms of the small house, singing and playing our instruments loudly. At 3 o'clock, we finally concluded our exorcism, and I scuffed out across the sodden park to find the McDougals. I found them sitting on a damp bench among the rhododendron bushes. The coast's clear, I said. You can go home now, and I hope get a good night's sleep tonight. The next morning, Mrs. McDougal reported that they had slept peacefully throughout the night, without disturbance coming from the attic. For the months that we stayed at Tittenhurst, the sounds were not heard again. The McDougals were immensely grateful to us and to Prabhupada for saving their sanity and their livelihood. This experience was something of a first for me, but I took it in stride and reasoned that this was a demonstration of how Krishna consciousness philosophy solved people's real-life problems in a practical way. I'd seen Krishna consciousness help improve people's health through vegetarianism, and I'd seen drug addicts come clean through practicing the philosophy that Prabhupada expounded. Now I could add to that list that I'd seen a home exercised through the chanting of Hare Krishna. Prabhupada himself seemed quite taken by the incident. At Conway Hall a few nights later, I was busy organizing something and wasn't paying much attention to Prabhupada's lecture. Then I heard him say, "We drove the ghost from John Lennon's house," and I couldn't help smiling at the fact that he told his audience about this in the middle of a lecture on Vedic philosophy.